Prodigal Summer, Disc 4.
Chapter 7. Predators. "Hey there," he said, as if Eddie Bondo himself standing in the trail were no more unexpected a find on this warm afternoon than the cluster of puffball mushrooms she'd paused just a minute before to admire. "Hey yourself," she answered quietly, as if her heart were not pounding at its cage like a sudden captive. "How'd you find me up here?"
"I sniffed you out, girl. You are a sweet, easy trail for a man to follow."
Her abdominal muscles tensed. He might have thought he was joking, but she knew some truths about human scent. She'd walked down city streets in Knoxville and turned men's heads, one after another, on the middle day of her cycle. They didn't know why, knew only that they wanted her. That was how pheromones seemed to work, in humans at least. Nobody liked to talk about it, maybe excepting Eddie Bondo. "I'm fertile, that's what got to you," she said frankly, testing him out, but he didn't flinch. "Just so you know, this is the day," she laughed. "That's what called you down from Clinch Peak." Eddie Bondo laughed too, shining that high-beam smile at her through the late morning drizzle. Could she pretend not to rejoice? How could she not want him back?
"How can you know a thing like that?" he asked.
"What, that my body's talking to yours?" She stomped her boot down on the puffballs, releasing a cloud of spores that rose and curled like golden brown smoke, glittering in the sunlit air between them. Sex cells, they were, a mushroom's bliss, its attempt to fill the world with its mushroom progeny. "Or how can I know about my timing? Which do you mean?" He stomped the puffballs too, squashing the leathery white skins like empty baseballs, releasing more puffs. The supply seemed endless. Deanna wondered if these tiny particles would cling to their damp skin or enter their bodies on an inhaled breath.
"Both, I guess," he said finally.
She shrugged. Was he serious? A woman knew both those things if she was paying attention. Deanna turned and headed up mountain, confident he would follow. "I sleep outside a lot," she said. "I'm on the same schedule as the moon."
He laughed. "What are you, a weir lady?"
She stopped and turned to look at him. It amazed her, the obvious animal facts people refused to know about their kind. Any woman will ovulate with the full moon if she's exposed to enough moonlight. It's the pituitary gland does it, I guess. It takes a while to get there, but then you stay. Eddie Bondo seemed amused by this information.
"So back in the old days when they slept on the ground around the fire, wrapped up in skins or however they did, then what? You're saying all the women in the world came into heat at the same time?"
She shrugged again, not really wanting to talk about it if he thought it was funny. It felt like betraying a secret.
"Convenient, if you think about it," she said. "Full moon, plenty of light." "Damn," he said. "No wonder that sucker drives men crazy."
"Yep." She turned uphill again, feeling his eyes on every muscle in her long, rain-slick thighs and calves, her gluteus maximus, and the small of her back as she mounted the slope. She was wearing cut-off jeans, a thin cotton shirt, and no bra. She'd had no thoughts of Eddie Bondo when she dressed that morning, only a rush of spring fever and evidently a body that wanted to be seen.
"Where are you going?" he asked.
"Out for a walk in the rain."
"It's just about let up," he contended, finally.
"Don't get used to it. We're in for more."
"Don't tell me that. How can you tell?"
How? About 6 different ways, she thought. First, a wind just strong enough to make the leaves show their white undersides. "I don't know," she said aloud, shutting that door out of habit, although it occurred to her that this might be the one man she'd met since her father died who would be interested to hear all 6.
"You hillbillies around here must have gills like fish. Last few weeks I've been thinking I was going to melt."
"You didn't, I see."
"Turns out I'm not made of sugar."
"Turns out."
she smiled to herself. So, where are you going?
Nowhere, a place I like to go.
He laughed. That sounds mighty unambitious.
No, I mean nowhere important, from a wildlife management point of view.
From anybody's point of view, probably. Well now, pretty lady, does that mean you're off duty?
She caught her breath, wondering at his power to manipulate her desire. She wanted to stop and tear him apart on the trail, swallow him alive, suck his juices, and lick him from her fingers. It's just a place I like, she said evenly. More a thing than a place. It's right up here at the top of these switchbacks. The trail was extremely steep from this point on to where it lay, the great old friendly hollowed-out shelter she was headed for, 100 more feet up the mountain. She could hear his footsteps and breathing right behind her, synchronized with hers.
Animal, vegetable, or mineral? He asked.
Vegetable. Dead vegetable, since way before we were born.
Is it a big old hollow tree?
She froze, but didn't turn around.
About 10 feet long and yay tall, so you just have to duck your head when you walk into it? Nope, never seen it.
She wheeled to face him, her braid flying.
That's my place. Don't you think a few other people might have run across it? It's been lying there about 100 years.
No, nobody else ever comes up here. She broke into a run, but he overtook her from behind, a little faster than she was at an uphill sprint. With his hands on her hips, he pulled but mostly pushed her, and before she could dodge him, they had reached the tunnel tree. There was no turning back from it now. There it was, and lodged in the shadows inside of it, stashed neatly away from the rain, were his things, his pack, his tin cup and coffee pot, his whole Eddie Bondo life. I can't believe you've been here, she said, still denying it to herself.
Lots of critters been here, don't you think?
No, she said, and nothing more, because his mouth was on hers and his body was pushing her inside. He moved his pack aside, moved her backward into the delicate darkness toward the tunnel's very center, the safest place. It's mine, she whispered.
Who cut it down, then?
She could see nothing but his face, feel nothing but the exquisite grain of his skin against her cheek and his hands on her buttons.
Nobody. It's a chestnut. Blight killed all the chestnuts 50 years ago. Nobody chopped it down.
She knew it was possible. Her dad had told her how people had watched the chestnuts mysteriously dying and rushed to take what was left standing since they needed the lumber so badly. But no, if somebody had gone to that trouble, he'd have taken the wood, not left it lying here for dead. She started to say this. No, but found she couldn't form the word against Eddie Bondo's lips. It became nonsensical beside the fact of her naked back pressed against the soft, black, crumbling, curved inside wall of this womb she had never shared with any twin. He held her breasts in his two hands, looking down at her. She couldn't bear how much she loved that gaze and that touch, those palms on her nipples and those fingertips tracing her ribs and enclosing her sides, pulling her against him as if she were something small and manageable. He kissed her neck, then her collarbones, stopped briefly then and stood up on his knees to fish for the crinkling packet in his jeans pocket, that premeditation. Of course, he knew she was fertile. He'd be careful. She sat curled with her back to the wall and her chin on her knees. The tunnel was wide enough that he could kneel in front of her, facing her, to untie her boots and slide off her shorts and his own clothes. It was warm enough for nakedness, a rich, dark warmth full of the scent of sweet old wood. He pressed his face against her knees.
"The full moon?" he asked, against her skin. "That's the secret of everything?"
She didn't say yes or no. His hands climbed her like a tree, from ankles to knees to waist to shoulders, until he cupped her face and looked into her eyes like a gypsy trying to read the future in tea leaves. He seemed so happy, so earnest.
For that, men write stupid poems and howl and hold up liquor stores, when all they really want is every woman in the world all at the same time?
She held his eyes but couldn't speak to tell him how far she'd left all that behind her, so far that even her obedient ovaries sometimes failed to be moved by the moon these days, these years in her middle 40s. Some months, no heads turned. She'd been so sure that was what she wanted. How could this be? Eddie Bondo looking in her eyes, taking hold of her braid and wrapping it around and around his wrist until he had her cheek pinned to his forearm and turned gently away from him. She lay face down with her head on her hands and the full length of his body against her, his penis gently pressing her solar plexus and his lips touching her temple. Between the skin of her back and his chest, she could feel small prickly islands of chestnut dust. "Deanna," he said in her ear. "I wanted you all the way from West Virginia. I was going to want you from here to Wyoming if I didn't come back." He breathed on the skin beneath her earlobe and her back arched like a reflex, like a moth drawn helpless to a flame. She had no words, but her body answered his perfectly as he slid himself down and took the nape of her neck in his teeth, like a lion on a lioness in heat. A gentle, sure bite, by mutual agreement, impossible to escape. By late morning, the rain had stopped completely, setting free a moment of afternoon sun. It stretched into the tunnel's mouth to lap at their naked feet and ankles as they lay side by side. The sensation roused Deanna from where she had been drifting, someplace near sleep but not quite in its full embrace. It was late, she realized with a start. She opened her eyes. This day was going, was gone already, she might as well say it, to him, her time and all the choices she thought she'd made for good. Her gut clenched as distant thunder rumbled and echoed up the hollow, threatening more rain. She stared at the man who lay flat on his back beside her, sleeping the untroubled sleep of a landlord. Flecks of soft wood and crumbled leaves, shreds of her forest, clung to his body, freckling his cheek and shoulder and even his limp penis. She filled up with loathing for his talkative cockiness, those placid eyelids and the dead careless arm slung across her, heavy as lead. She threw it off of her and rolled away from him, but he moved from sleep to partial wakefulness and reached to draw her back to him. "No," she said, shoving him hard. "Just no, get off me." His eyes flew open, but Deanna couldn't stop her fists from lashing out hard at his chest and shoulders. A bile rose up in her gut, a rush of physical rage that might have branded him black and blue if her arms had found the strength for it before he gathered back his hunter's wits. She nearly spit in his face when he restrained her with a grip like handcuffs on her forearms. This fury had taken her like a storm and left her trembling.
"God, Deanna."
"Let me go."
"Not if you're going to kill me. God, woman."
He held her forearms upright on either side of her face and studied her like a bad mistake, like some mountain lion he'd accidentally caught in a leg hold trap for squirrel.
"Just let me go," she said. "I want to get my clothes on."
Carefully, he opened one hand, then the other, watching her arms as she moved away from him.
"What?"
he asked.
"Why did you come back?"
She spat the words.
"You seemed pretty happy about it an hour ago."
She shook her head slowly, breathed out through her nose, pressed her lips together so hard they turned white. He persisted.
"You didn't want me to come back?"
She hated that, too, his not knowing. She couldn't look at him.
"Christ almighty, Deanna, what?"
"I didn't need you here."
"I know that."
"You don't know anything. You never saw me alone."
"I did, though."
There was a hint of that grin in his voice. She turned to face him with an animal glare. "Is that it? You were watching me like some damn predator, and you think you have me now?" He didn't answer this. She turned her back on him again. "I was just fine here before you showed up. For 2 years, while you were doing whatever you did all that time, I was right here, not missing people or all that chit-chat about the stuff they think they need to have or wear or make happen. For sure, not pining for a boyfriend." He didn't respond. A scarlet tanager broke the silence with his song.
She thought of the bird hidden in leaves somewhere, unseen by any human eye, but nevertheless brilliant red, nevertheless beautiful. And then one day you're here, Eddie Bondo, and then one day you're not. What's that supposed to mean?
He spoke slowly. It's not supposed to mean anything.
Damn straight it's not.
I'm gone then. No problem. Is that what you're saying you want?
She grabbed her shirt and put it on, dusting damp sawdust from her skin and feeling angry and pathetic. The shirt was inside out, she realized when she tried to button it, so she tied the tails in a knot instead and quickly pulled on her shorts. She hoped to God he wasn't looking at her. She tried to slow down her breathing and remember what she used to be. She crawled to the end of the tunnel and sat there at the edge, facing out, right on the margin where old chestnut wood dissolved into leafy forest floor.
Deanna, I said, do you want me to go?
No, and I'll tell you straight, I despise you for it.
For what?
She still didn't turn around to look at him, didn't need to see that face, spoke to the woods instead. For shit, for me wanting you to come back. When this day started, she'd been content. Finally, after 15 days of heart race and butterfly stomach over any crackle in the woods that might have been his footstep, she'd stopped listening. She was sure of it. She could recall the even-keeled pleasure of hiking up the trail alone, thinking of nothing but this log, trying to picture how the forest had looked back when chestnuts were the dominant tree of the eastern forests. It was something she could see in her mind's eye. This giant would have been the tallest, most immortal thing on its mountain, until the day a fungal blight stepped off a ship in some harbor, grinned at America, and took down every chestnut tree from New York to Alabama. A whole landscape could change just like that. She sat still, ignoring her own body and the one that breathed behind her. Out in the light, she could almost see the calm air beginning to gather itself for the afternoon, the oxygen burgeoning between the damp leaves. These trees were the lungs of her mountain. Not her mountain, nobody's damn mountain. This mountain that belonged to scarlet tanagers, puffballs, luna moths, and coyotes. This shadowy, spirited world she lived in was preparing to exhale. It would be afternoon. And then it would be evening, and then night. It would pour down rain. He would share her bed. She wiped tears from the side of her face with the back of her wrist and reached out with her other hand to press her fingertips into the soft, crumbling wood. She touched her fingers to her upper lip, breathing that earthy smell, tasting the wood with her tongue. She had loved this old log fiercely. It embarrassed her to admit it. Only a child was allowed to love an inanimate thing so desperately, or possess it so confidently. But it had been hers. Now the spell was gone, the magic of this place that had been hers alone, unknown to any man. Chapter 8. Moth Love. Lusa stood on the front porch, watching rain pour over the front eave in long silver strings. The gabled roof of the farmhouse, her farmhouse, was made of grooved tin that shunted the water into channels running down its steep sides. Some of the trickles poured over as clear filaments, like fishing line, while others looked beaded, like strings of pearls. She'd put buckets on the wide steps under some of the trickles and discovered that each string of droplets tapped out its own distinctive rhythm in its bucket. All morning, the rhythm of each stream never changed. It only grew softer as the bucket filled, then returned to its hollow rat-tat-a-rat-tat-tat after she emptied the bucket. She'd set out the buckets to collect a drink for the potted ferns on the porch, which were out of the rain's reach and turning brown, even in this soggy weather, as brittle and desolate as her internal grief. She'd meant to return to her work, but the rhythms arrested her. It was a relief to stand still for a minute, listening, without anyone giving her pitying looks and ordering her to go lie down. Hanny Mavis and Jewel had gone home, finally, though they still came up several times a day to check on her, which mostly meant telling her to eat, even what to eat, as if she were a child. But then they'd go away afterward. Lucy could stand on her own porch in a pair of jeans and Cole's work shirt and watch the rain and let her mind go numb if she felt like it. If she hadn't had a gallon of cherries to pit and pack into canning jars, she could have amused herself all morning out here, setting a bucket under each downspout and making up a song to go with it. Her grandfather Landowski's game. He used to tap out unexpected rhythms with his fingertips on her bony knees, inventing mysterious Balkan melodies that he'd hum against the beat. "You're Zeta, the last landowner in our line," her father used to declare sarcastically, because his father had had a sugar beet farm on the Nere River north of Lodz, and he'd lost it in the war, fleeing Poland in possession of nothing but his life, a young son and wife, and a clarinet. "Your great Zeta, who made a name for himself in New York as a klezmer musician, before leaving his wife and child for an American girl he met in a nightclub." Lucy knew, though it wasn't discussed, that with his young mistress, the old man had even sired a second family, all of whom perished in a tenement fire, her Zeta included. It was hard to say which part of the story Lucy's father held against him. Most of it, she supposed. When they flew to New York to witness the burial of the charred remains, Lucy was still too young to understand her father's feelings and all the ironies of the loss. Zeta Landowski hadn't visited her mind for many years, and now here he was, in a syncopated string of water drops on a farmhouse porch in Zebulon County. He'd started out as a farmer before bending the rest of his life around loss. What would he have made of a rainy day in this hollow, with its rich smells of decomposition and sweet new growth? Lucy smoothed her shirt tail and composed herself to look busy and well-nourished, for here came Herb and Mary Edna's green truck bouncing up the drive. But it was not the menacing eldest behind the wheel this time. It was her husband Herb, Lucy saw as he pulled up in front of the house, and Lois's husband, Big Ricky, who got out on the passenger's side. Both men tucked their heads down and held the bills of their caps with their right hands as they jogged toward her through the rain. They ducked through the beaded curtain of drips, carefully avoiding her buckets on the steps, and stomped their boots several times on the porch floorboards before taking off their caps. The scents rising from their work overalls put Cole right there with them. Dust, motor oil, barn hay. She breathed in, drawing from strange men's clothes these molecules of her husband.
"He needs a gutter put on this porch," Ricky told Herb, as if they also agreed to the fact of Cole's presence here, and Lucy's absence. What mission required this delegation of husbands? Were they going to order her to leave now, or what? Would she put up a fight or go peacefully?
"Ricky, Herb," she said, squaring her shoulders. "Nice to see you." Both men nodded at her, then glanced back out at the rain, the absent gutter, and the waterlogged fields where they seemed eager to return to work. She eyed the green cockleburrs planted like tiny landmines on the cuffs of their khaki trousers.
"Another good hard rain," Herb observed. "Too bad we need it like a hole in the head. One more week of this, the frogs'll drown." "Supposed to clear up by Saturday, though," said Ricky. "That's right," Herb agreed. "Otherwise we wouldn't have bothered you, but it's supposed to clear up."
"To tell me it's supposed to stop raining, you came up here?" Lucy asked, looking from one sun-toughened face to the other for some clue. It was always like this, any time she got wedged into a conversation with her brothers-in-law. This sense of having wandered into a country where they spoke English, but all the words meant something different.
"Yep," said Herb.
Ricky nodded to corroborate. They looked like a comedy team. Stout, bald Herb was the front man, while tall, gangling Ricky stood mostly silent with his cap in hand and his wild black hair molded to the shape of his cap. He had an Adam's apple like a round oak gall on the stalk of his long neck. People called him Big Ricky, even though his son, Little Ricky, had, at 17, surpassed him in many ways. Luther felt some sympathy with Little Ricky's fate. Life in Zebulon. The minute you're born, you're trapped like a bug, somebody's son or wife, a place too small to fit into.
So, Herb interjected into the silence, we'll be needing to set Cole's tobacco.
Oh, Lucy said, surprised. It's time for that, isn't it?
I'll tell you the truth, it's past time. All this rain's been keeping everybody's fields mucked up, and now here it is, June, pretty near too late.
Well, it's only, what, the 5th or something, June 5th?
That's right. Blue mold will be setting in here come July if the plants aren't up big enough by then.
You can spray for blue mold if you have to, Lucy said. Tobacco pathology was not exactly her department, but she'd heard Cole speak of it. She felt desperate to know something in front of these men.
Can, they agreed, with limited enthusiasm.
Have you both got your own tobacco plants in? You should go ahead and do your own first. Herb nodded.
I leased out my allotment this year, since them darned cows are keeping me too busy to mess with it. Me and him got Big Ricky's in on Monday morning, when we had that break in the weather, and that puts Cole next.
And what about Jewel, Lucy wondered. Are they also running her life, since her husband ran off with a waitress from Cracker Barrel?
So, what you're saying is, she interpreted cautiously, her heart pounding in her ears, on Saturday, you and your boys will be coming up here to set the tobacco?
That's right, if it dries out for a day first.
And what about me? Do I get a say?
Both men glanced at her with the exact same eye, surprised, fearful, put out. But wasn't it her farm? She looked away from them, inhaling the rich scents of mud and honeysuckle and listening to her childish project, her bucket on the step.
Tat, tat, a tat, tat, a tat, tat, tat.
She heard a song against the beat, distinctly, the trilling clarinet rising like laughter and the mandolin as insistent as clapping hands. Klezmer music.
It's my farm now, she said aloud. Her voice quavered and her fingers felt hot.
Yep, Herb agreed.
But we don't mind helping Cole out like any other year. Tobacco's a lot of work, takes a whole family. That's how people around here do it anyways.
I was here last year, she said tersely. I brought hot coffee out to you and Cole and Little Ricky and that other boy, that cousin from Tazewell, if you recall.
Big Ricky smiled.
I recall you trying your hand at riding behind the tractor and setting a row of plants. Some of them ended up with their roots a-dangling up in the air and their leaves planted in the ground.
Cole drove too fast on purpose. We were just newlyweds. He was teasing me in front of you guys.
Lucy flushed pink up to the hairline, remembering her ride on the little platform attached to the rear of the tractor, grabbing the floppy young tobacco plants from the box beside her. Their disintegrating texture was like that of tissue paper. Trying to plunge them into the chunky clay of the furrow as it passed beneath her seemed impossible. They had been married only 2 days.
It was my first time behind a tractor, she contended.
It was, Big Ricky conceded. And most of them plants was roots down.
Herb steered back to the business at hand.
We got no sets of our own left, but Big Ricky got up a good price on a batch from Jackie Doddard.
I appreciate that, but what if I don't want to plant tobacco this year?
You don't have to do a thing. You can stay in the house if you want to.
No, I mean, what if I don't want tobacco planted on my farm?
Now they did not glance at Lucy sideways. They stared.
Well, she said, why plant more tobacco when everybody's trying to quit smoking? Or should be trying to, if they're not already. The government's officially down on it now that word's finally out that cancer's killing people, and everybody's blaming us.
Both men turned their eyes out toward the rain and the fields, where it was clear they suddenly wished they could be, rain or no rain. She could see them working hard not to finger the packs of Marlboros in their shirt pockets.
What would you be wanting to plant then? Herb asked at last.
Well, I hadn't really thought. What about corn? Herb and Big Ricky exchanged a smile, passing the joke between them.
"About $3 a bushel, that's how about it," Herb replied. "Unless you mean feed corn, that's more like 50 cents a bushel around here. But of course you'd be talking about sweet corn."
"Of course," Lucy said.
"Well, let's see. Cole's got a 5-acre tobacco bottom, so put it in sweet corn. That'd get you about 500 bushels, maybe 6 in a good year. Not that we ever have one of them around here."
Herb rolled his eyes up, counting on his fingers.
"About $1,500, minus your diesel for your tractor, your seed, and a whole bunch of fertilizer, 'cause corn's a heavy feeder, and some luck getting it sold on the right day. You might end up making near about, $800 on your corn crop."
"Oh, I see." Lucy blushed deeper. "We usually clear around 12 or 13,000 for the tobacco."
"Yep," said Big Riggy. "That'd be about right. 3,700 an acre minus your tractor costs, your sets, and your chemicals."
"It's what we live on." She'd said it softly, but the words "we" and "live" hung heavily in the air. She felt them pressing on her shoulders like the hands of a disapproving matron trying to get the message across to a selfish child. "Sit down. Your turn is over."
Tat, 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 tat.
Grandfather Landowski's rhythm section was fading out. She needed to empty the buckets and start them over again. She wished these men would go away. Just leave her to muddle through in her own way, however mistaken. She wished she could ask someone for advice without feeling skinned alive and laughed at.
"What else can people grow around here on little scraps of land at the bottom of a hollow?" she asked. "What can you earn enough to live on besides tobacco?"
Big Ricky warmed to the subject of bad news. "Well, Turner Blevins up there tried tomatoes. They told him he could get $10,000 an acre. What they didn't tell him was that if two other guys in the county tried the same thing, they've done flooded the market. Blevins fed 3,500 pounds of tomatoes to his hogs and dished the rest under."
"What about the other two guys?" Lucy asked.
"Same. They all three lost money. One of them was so sold on tomatoes, he put him in a $10,000 irrigation system to water him with, is what I heard. Now he's back in tobacco and just hoping for a real dry year so he can turn on his fancy spanking hoses."
"But that doesn't make sense, that they'd all lose money. People need lots of tomatoes."
"Not all on the same day, they don't, and that's how tomatoes comes in. If you can't get them suckers all into somebody's grocery cart in 5 days or less, then you've got you some expensive hog food. And out here in the boondocks, no shipper's gonna touch you before he's sure he can make his cut."
Lucy crossed her arms, despairing of the depth of her ignorance.
"Your tobacco, you see now," Ricky continued. "You hang it in the barn to cure, and then it can just go on hanging there as long as it needs to till the time's good to sell. Everybody in the county can grow tobacco, but every leaf of it might get lit and smoked on a different day of the year in a different country of the world."
"Imagine that," Lucy said, sounding sarcastic, though she was actually a little astonished. She'd never thought through these basic lessons before. Tobacco's value largely lay in the fact that it kept forever and traveled well. They stood silent for a while, all three of them staring out into the yard. The rain fell on the big leaves of the catalpa tree, popping them down like keys on a typewriter. Lucy said, "There's got to be something else I can make decent money on. The barn's got to have a new roof this year."
Herb smirked. "Mary J. Wanna. I hear that brings in about the same price per acre as tomatoes, and the market's solid."
"I see," Lucy said. "You're making fun of me. Well, I appreciate your offer to set this weekend, but I'd like to think about the tobacco. Can you still get the sets from Jackie if I let you know tomorrow or the next day?"
"I expect so. Jackie's got that hydroponic set up. It didn't work out too good last year, but this year he's done growed more than he knows what to do with."
"Well, good. I'll let you know then, before Saturday. I'll decide what to do."
"If it stops raining," Herb said, lest Lucy think she was in charge.
"Right. And if it doesn't, then we're all sunk together, right? I'll make the same nothing off the tobacco I didn't grow as you will off the crop you tried to get put in. And think of the time and money I'll save." Herb stared at her. Big Ricky smiled out toward the garage.
"That's a smart lady, Herb," he said. "I believe she's got the right attitude for farming."
"Well," Lucy said, slapping her hands together, "I've got a gallon of cherries in there that are going to rot if I don't get them canned today, so I'll call you Friday." Herb leaned out toward the edge of the porch, looking up the mountainside toward the orchard. She was controlling her breathing, counting the seconds until these two got into the truck and lit their cigarettes and drove away and she could sob on the porch swing. Standing up to them took almost more guts than she had.
"I'm surprised you got Cherry One off them trees this year," Herb pronounced. "As many darn jaybirds as we've had. Last spring I come over here and shot the birds all out of there for coal, but I never got around to it this year. So you got you enough for a pie or two anyways, did you?"
Lucy managed to grimace a smile, wide-eyed and fierce. "Miracles happen, Herb." That would be Jewel at the door, Lucy thought. Jewel thumping her umbrella out in the front hallway. They'd always come in without knocking, all of them, even when Lucy and Cole were newlyweds stealing sex in the afternoons. Jewel's tired voice telling the kids to wipe their feet and hang up their raincoats on the pegs. Then they poured through the kitchen doorway, the older child carrying a box of canning jars on his head, balancing it with both hands. Lucy had called Jewel when she ran out of canning jars. "Come on in," she said. "You can set the box right down there on the counter."
"Lord, call the police," Jewel cried. "There's been a murder in here."
Lucy laughed. "Looks like it, doesn't it?" Her apron and the countertops were smeared garishly with the blood of hundreds of cherries. The hand-cranked pitter was clamped to the counter, a mass of dark pits glistening in the bucket underneath, like something from a slaughterhouse. She'd been relieved when Jewel offered over the phone to come up and help her finish the canning. Lucy could recognize objectively, without really feeling it, that she needed company or she'd go crazy. Yet here was her sister-in-law with her hand to her mouth already, mortified by her slip, a joke about death. Lucy had hoped for a sturdier kind of company than this. "It's okay, Jewel. I know Cole's dead."
"Well, I didn't, stupid me, I didn't think." She looked anguished.
Lucy shrugged. "It's not like you're going to remind me of something I've forgotten about." Jewel stood a minute longer with her hand to her mouth and tears welling, staring at Lucy, while her 10-year-old slowly circumnavigated the kitchen island, balancing the cardboard box of jars one-handed. The younger child, Lowell, reached up to steal a handful of cherries off the butcher block. Jewel gently swatted his hand away.
"Aren't people awful?" she asked Lucy, finally. "I know what you're saying. When Shell..."
But she stopped herself to shoo out the kids. "Go play outside."
"Mom, it's pouring down rain."
"It's pouring down rain, Jewel. They can play on the back porch."
"Okay, the back porch then, but don't bust anything."
"Hey, wait a sec, Chris. Here." Lucy scooped a pile of cherries into a plastic bowl and handed it to the older boy. "If you run out of stuff to do, there's a broom and a dustpan out there."
"To sweep with?"
"To play hockey with, you're asking?" "Yes, to sweep with." Jewel waited for the door to close behind them before she spoke.
"When Shell left me, everybody just stopped saying his name or word one about him like I'd never even been married. But we were, for some of those years, I mean married. Even while we were still just dating, if you know what I mean. We ran off to Cumberland Falls 2 months before the wedding and called it our test drive honeymoon."
For just a few seconds, she stared at her hands with a faraway satisfaction, the most womanly expression Lucy had ever seen on Jewel. But then it vanished.
"I swear it's sad," she finished, matter-of-factly.
"Pretending that a part of my life never happened."
She began to unscrew the clamp that held the antique steel cherry pitter to the counter. Lucy had spent half an hour solving the puzzle of that clamp. But of course, the pitter had been their mother's. Jewel would know it with her eyes closed. This family's intimidating, no doubt about it, Lusa said. She wished she could say how hard it really was, how it felt to live among people who'd been using her kitchen appliances since before she was born. How they attacked her in unison if she tried to rearrange the furniture or hang her own family pictures. How even old Mrs. Widener haunted this kitchen, disapproving of Lucy's recipes and jealous of her soups. "Oh, it's not just the family," Jewel said. "It's everybody. It's this town. 4 years it's been, and I still see people at Kroger's go into a different checkout line so they won't have to stand there and not say something to me about Shell." Lusa mopped red juice from the counter with a sponge. "You'd think in 4 years they could come up with a new subject." "You'd think. Not that it's the same. Shell's running off and Cole's being dead," Lusa said. "It's the same. Around here, people act like losing your husband was contagious." Lusa had been amazed at how quickly her status had changed. Being single made her either invisible or dangerous, or both, like a germ. She'd noticed it even at the funeral, especially among the younger ones, wives her own age who needed to believe marriage was a safe and final outcome.
"Well, at least everybody knows you didn't do anything to run your husband off."
Lusa took a pinafore apron out of the drawer and put the neck strap over Jewel's head, then turned her around to tie the back.
"What, and you did? God knows, hand-to-mouth farming is a life anybody would run from. I considered leaving Cole 100 times, not because of him, just because of everything."
"Lord, I know, it's a misery," Jewel said,
though just then they were both gazing out the kitchen window at a drenched, billowy mock orange in full bloom in the backyard, and it was beautiful. Lusa took up her sponge again.
"Don't you dare tell your sisters I thought about leaving Cole. They'd chop me up and hide the pieces in canning jars."
Jewel laughed.
"You make us sound so mean, honey."
She donned an oven mitt and lifted the huge flat lid of the water bath canner, holding it high in the air like a symbol.
"You want me to put the jars in to sterilize?"
"Go ahead. What do you think I've got here, about 8 quarts? Jewel appraised the mound of pitted cherries on the stained cutting board, doing some form of math in her head, Lusa realized. She understood with some chagrin that she'd accepted the family's judgment of Jewel as a child and not a woman, simply because she was manless.
"Are you doing preserves, honey, or pie filling?"
"Preserves, I guess, if I don't run out of sugar. I already made 18 pints.
"Of preserves?"
Lusa felt foolish. "It's a lot, I know. When I was up the ladder out there in the tree, I was proud of myself for filling up buckets. But now I'm stuck with them."
"Oh, no, you'll be glad to have that jam. They're the sweet cherries, aren't they, off that double-trunked tree above the apple orchard? Boy, those are the best cherries. Daddy must have planted that tree before him and Mommy married. It was already big when we were kids."
"Really?" Lusa took in her gut the familiar pang of guilt for owning this tree that Jewel had grown up loving.
"Yeah. They always said it got hit by lightning the winter Cole was born. That's how it got split in two that way, lightning."
A lightning strike and a jackknifed truck, two unexpected events circumscribing a life. Lusa knew how far down that road her mind could go, so she made herself stop. She wondered instead how old Jewel had been that winter of his birth, whether she'd grown up as Cole's playmate or his keeper. She'd never asked him these things about each of his sisters. She'd expected to have years to untangle those threads. Jewel must have sensed her gloom because she spoke up brightly.
18 pints is enough preserves. Let's can the rest for pie filling."
"I can't see myself making pies anymore for just me, since nobody seems to want to come here for dinner."
"Mary Edna was a stinker to you over that. There wasn't any reason for her to get so high and mighty. Emmeline thinks so, too. She told me. We both wish we could still have Thanksgiving up here at the house."
Lucy's head swam with this news. She'd never suspected she had allies at all, much less the support of a faction. How had she gotten here, stranded in this family without rhyme or reason? Suddenly she felt so exhausted by grief that she had to sink into a chair and put her head down on the table. Jewel let her be. Lucy could hear the jars clinking gently together, settling into the boiling water bath. Finally, Jewel whispered, "I think you got about 6 quarts to go, no more." "That's still a lot of preserves. Let's make pie cherries then, and if there's any left over, we'll make some pies today. You make the best pie crust of anybody, better than Mommy's, I hate to say it." "God, don't say it out loud. Your mother haunts this kitchen. She used to stand in here stirring up fights between Cole and me." Jewel gasped in mock dismay. "Now why would Mommy do that?" "The usual thing, territorial jealousy." The boys banged in through the screen door, preceded by their empty bowl like a pair of cooperative beggars. The minute Lusa refilled it, though, Want ceded to possession, and they started to slap and fight. "Ow! Chris won't share!" Lowell howled. "Goodness, we've got no shortage of cherries in this kitchen. Here, I'll get you your own bowl." Lusa was careful to find another one the same size and to fill them both equally. When they retreated again to the back porch, she felt a flush of pride at having satisfied them, however briefly. Children were not Lucy's element. That was how she'd always put it to Cole, that babies made her nervous. Since moving here, though, she'd had glimpses of how the indulgence of adult despair could yield to children's needs. 5.5 quarts, like I was saying," Jewel laughed. "Excuse me for having pigs instead of children. I think I can bear the loss." Lucy sat down at the table again, facing the army of jars she'd already put up this day, little glass soldiers stuffed with their bright red organs. Who would eat all this? When she left, would she take her preserves back to Lexington in a U-Haul? "What am I doing this for?" she asked suddenly in a dull, hard voice. Jewel was behind her at once, rubbing her shoulders. "For later," she said simply. "I should live so long." "What on earth do you mean by that?" "Nothing," Lucy said. "I just can't picture later. Spending my nothing of a life in this kitchen cooking for nobody." "I wish you'd make a pie for my kids once in a while. When I get home from work, I'm so tired I practically feed them hog slop on a bun." Lucy wondered whether this was a real request or an attempt at redeeming her empty life. "I could make a pie and bring it down sometime." Jewel sat down, brushing a strand of mouse-colored hair out of her eyes. "That's not what I was asking for. I don't know if this is, well, polite to ask, but could they come up here and eat dinner with you sometimes?" Lucy studied her sister-in-law's face. She seemed so tired. The request was genuine. "Well, sure," she said. "You could too, Jewel, if you didn't feel like cooking. I could use the company." "But, I mean, if I wasn't here." "What, like if you had to take the late shift at Kroger's? You know you can ask me that any time. I'm glad to help out." "You wouldn't care to have the kids up here sometimes then?" Lucy smiled. "Of course not." It had taken her a year to learn that when mountain people said, "I don't care to," they meant the opposite of what she thought. They meant, "I wouldn't mind." Jewel held her eye, shy and bold at the same time. "But they said you're going back to Lexington pretty soon." "Who did?" She shrugged. "I can see why you would. I'm just saying I'd miss you." Lucy took a breath. "Would you get this house and the land then?" "Oh, no, Mary Edna would, I guess. She's the oldest. I don't even have a man to farm it." "So, Mary Edna wants the place." "It's yours, honey. You could sell it or whatever you want. Cole didn't have any will, so it goes to you." "She said they have that law now, a success statue or something, where it used to be the family would get a farm back, but now it goes to the wife." Lucy felt a rush of adrenaline through her limbs. Only one thing could account for Jewel's acquaintance with success statues. They were consulting lawyers. "I haven't made up my mind about anything yet," she said. "I haven't been able to think straight since everything happened." You seem like you're doing good, honey. Lusa looked at Jewel, longing to trust, knowing she couldn't. She felt dismayed by the complexities of even the simplest of things, a conversation with a sister, not her own, in a kitchen, also not her own. "Probably you all think I'm not behaving like a decent widow," she said, surprised by the anger in her chest. Jewel started to protest, but Lusa shook her head. "You see me pushing right along, canning cherries like everything was normal, but when nobody's here, sometimes I have to lie down on the floor and just try to keep breathing. What am I supposed to do, Jewel? I'm 28. I've never been a widow before. How does a widow act?" Jewel offered no advice. Lusa took one of the jelly jars in her hand and stared at its ruby redness, that clear, proud color that she knew she loved, theoretically, but that couldn't touch her just now. "I grew up in a family where suffering was quiet," she said. "My father is a man who's lost everything, his family's land, his own father, his faith, and now his wife's companionship. All for unfair reasons, and he's just kept working all his life. I was always more of a complainer, but I'm learning to be quiet. It seems like the only grown-up way to face this brutal thing that's happened." Jewel's eyes were so much like coals, so earnest and perfectly blue, that Lusa had to look away from her. "I may look like I'm doing all right, but I don't know if I'm coming or going. Whoever told you my plans knows more than I do." Jewel put her hand on her mouth, a nervous habit apparently. "It's none of my business, but there wasn't any life insurance, was there?" Lusa shook her head. "Cole wasn't planning on dying this year. We'd talked about insurance, but with everything so tight, it just seemed like one extra payment we didn't need. We thought maybe we'd do it after we had kids or something." "I'll tell you something. Mary Edna and Herb could help with the burial. I would if I could, but they can. Herb and his brother are doing good with their dairy over on 6. That's Herb's family's land, paid off, so they're set up pretty good right now." "I can cover the burial. It's done. That was our savings. Mary Edna didn't offer, and I sure wasn't going to ask." "Mary Edna's bark's a whole lot worse than her bite." "It's not that. You know why. I'm not stupid, Jewel. I know what everybody's saying. Here I am, living in this house you all grew up in, on your family's land, the so-called Widener place, and there's no longer any Widener on the premises. Do you think I'd feel comfortable asking your family for anything?" Jewel gave her an odd look. "Is that true? Lois told me that you were going to take your maiden name back now." "What? No, I never did." Lusa wondered how far the misunderstandings went, and whether any of it would be possible to untangle after a point. "Well, anyway," Jewel said, "having a house and a farm's not the same as having money." "Tell me. When I hear people hinting I'm a gold digger, I feel like publishing my damn debts in the newspaper. I've got a barn to re-roof before winter, and this house, too, probably in the next year or two. And something's wrong with the spring box. I'm just waiting for the day I wake up and have no water. And what else? Oh, yes, Cole's brand new Kubota, $22,000, which won't be paid off for another 4 years. I didn't know he'd finance the tractor." Was Jewel spying? What difference would it make if they knew she was destitute? None, Lusa decided. "He didn't want to, but we had to have a tractor, and he deserved new. That John Deere of your daddy's was older than Cole, I think. He'd been fighting with it his whole life, holding it together with baling twine and fence wire. That tractor was older than Cole, come to think of it. And now I'll have to pay somebody to mow hay and put it in the barn and fix the fences and round up the cows when they get over on the neighbors and mess with the baler, which breaks down every single time you use it. And run and repair the bush hog and the sidearm mower, or am I supposed to learn to do all that myself? I'm sure there are other costs, too. I just don't know enough to see them coming." "Lord, Lord," Jewel said softly. Her face was the saddest thing Lusa had seen in a stretch of many sad days. Her forehead was deeply creased, and her eyes looked like an old woman's. At close range, she looked much older than Lusa had thought she was. "No man to farm it," Lusa summarized. "As you put it. Herb and Big Ricky will help you out." "Oh, they've been up here. I guess they're in charge now. Cole's grave isn't yet healed over, and already I'm nobody."
"What do you mean?"
"Well, I need help, sure, but help. It would be nice to be asked, instead of bossed around like a child. Do they do that to you?"
"They don't have any business with me. I don't even plant a garden anymore. I praise the Lord for my job at Kroger's and beg him to strike Shell dead if that check should fail to keep coming for the kids."
"What about Emmeline and Frank?"
"Emmeline and Frank are officially out of farming for good, they say, and I think they're just as happy about it, to both have factory jobs instead of farming.
But I heard Frank complaining at the funeral about losing his tobacco lease, and he complains about commuting to Leesport."
"Frank would complain about the moon if it looked at him wrong. He makes good money at Toyota, and he likes everybody to know it."
"So who's still farming? Just Lois and Big Ricky? And Herb? How can I live smack in the middle of you all and not know what's what?"
"Well, because it's not really settled, that's why. About half the time, Hanny Mavis and Joel lease out their allotment to a big grower over to Roanoke, like Herb does. Then the next year, they won't. But Lois and Big Ricky always do their own tobacco, 4 acres and some. You might not know it, but he and Joel's got land leased all over the county running beef cattle, too. Big Ricky's got farmer in his blood."
Both women jumped at the sound of a crash and breaking glass from the porch. Lusa started for the door, but Jewel stopped her, holding up a pair of tongs.
"You take the jars out of the canner and get the syrup boiling. I'll be back in a jiffy."
Lusa could hear Jewel scolding and both kids crying or whining on the porch. She tiptoed to look out the high window over the sink.
"Jewel," she called, "if it's those jars of green beans, it's a good riddance. They've been out there since I moved in."
There was no answer, and from this angle she couldn't see Jewel or the kids, but could hear a smack and a wail.
"That is no way to treat your little brother," she heard. "You keep this up and you're wearing a dress tomorrow. I mean it."
Lusa frowned and turned to the stove. She measured equal parts sugar and hot water into the pot, hoping 3 quarts of syrup would be the right amount to cover 5 quarts of raw-pack cherries. She should put in something acidic to lower the pH for the canning, but she didn't have any lemon juice. Would vinegar work? She added 1 tablespoon, a wild guess, then took up the tongs to lift the sterilized jars from the water bath. She lined them up on the counter, a raft of wide-mouthed birds begging to be fed.
"It was the green beans," Jewel sighed, coming inside. "I got all the glass. I told them to clean up the rest and throw it out by the creek and then go play in the barn or something. I don't care if it's raining. They won't melt."
"That's fine. Truly, I'm glad about the beans. I've been scared to eat them and scared to give them away. My luck, I'd kill somebody of botulism." Jewel reached under the sink to shake a dustpan of broken glass like wind chimes into the trash.
"She's going to be my death if I don't kill her first. Lowell's a handful, but he's just little. Crystal Gale's something else. It's time for her to be growing out of this stage, which she's been going through since the day she was born. What?"
Lusa realized she must look comically confused.
"Crystal?
Chris. Oh!" Jewel laughed, waved her hand. "You thought she was a boy. You and everybody else. When she started kindergarten, the teacher refused to let her go to the girls' bathroom until I rushed down there with her birth certificate."
"Oh."
Jewel looked earnest.
"Don't think it's because of Shell leaving, some child of divorce thing. She's always been this way."
"I don't think anything about it, Jewel. I just didn't realize."
"You can't imagine. It's been going on since she was a baby. Her first word was no, and her second was dress. No dress. No dolls. No pretty hair bows. I gave in on that haircut because she was cutting it herself. I was afraid she'd poke her eyes out."
Jewel looked so vulnerable. Lusa could practically see the veins through her skin. She wanted to hug her, to trust her completely. "It doesn't matter," she said. "I'm just glad you told me so I won't keep using the wrong pronoun. I can't believe I've known that child for a year, and nobody ever set me straight."
"You and Cole only ever had eyes for each other, honey. You hardly came to family things anyway, and if you did, it wasn't to look at my crazy mixed-up daughter."
"Ouch," Lusa said, burning her hand slightly on the rim of a jar.
"She's not crazy. Don't do that to yourself. I wouldn't worry about it."
"You would if you were her mother. You'd worry yourself sick. She's about half the reason why Shell left. He blamed me. Oh, Lord, did he blame me. He said I was making her a little homo by letting her wear jeans and cut her hair like that. And maybe he was right, but it wasn't my idea. I'd like to have seen him try and get her into a dress. That's what I told him. You try putting pantyhose on a tomcat."
Jewel and Lusa looked at each other and laughed.
"And anyway," Jewel asked a little shyly, "isn't a homo a man?"
"Jewel, she's just a tomboy. I was exactly like that at her age."
"You were? But you're so pretty, and you cook."
Lusa felt awkwardly flattered, though she was also aware that this wasn't the point.
"You should have seen me. I skinned my knees and caught bugs and wanted to be a farmer when I grew up."
"Careful what you wish for.
The syrup's boiling."
"Do you put a dash of vinegar in it or not? Oh, good, you did. I can smell it. Here, you hold the funnel over the jars and I'll pour. Where's your ladle?"
Jewel knew exactly where the ladle was, and everything else in this kitchen. The question was a gift of respect. Lusa retrieved the ladle from its drawer and closed it with her hip, feeling acutely grateful.
"Crystal's pretty. The name, I mean."
Jewel shook her head.
"It doesn't look like her. She looks like Beaver Cleaver."
Lusa smiled. "Misa Madel Sheena Dama," she said, her grandfather's promise, which had finally come true for what it was worth.
"What?"
"Ugly ducklings grow up to be swans." Lusa felt frustrated again. This wasn't really her wish, to promise that Chris would grow up straight and feminine, because maybe she wouldn't. Her wish was to tell Jewel that the alternative would be fine, too. But Lusa couldn't imagine having that conversation with Jewel.
"Maybe it's not really about trying to act like a boy," she hazarded cautiously, "but just her way of trying to be herself."
"Let's don't talk about it. Chris is just Chris. Tell me some gossip. Tell me why you're mad at Big Ricky and Herb."
Lusa poured 4 cups of cherries into each jar, then held the funnel steady over the mouth as Jewel covered them with boiling syrup.
"I'm not mad, I don't guess. I mean, I am, but I shouldn't be. I know they meant well."
"Well, but what did they do?"
"They came up this morning to inform me that they're going to set my tobacco on Saturday."
"And?"
"And I don't want to grow tobacco."
"You don't? Why not?"
"Oh, I'm being stupid, I guess. Farm economics, what do I know? But half the world's starving, Jewel. We're sitting on some of the richest dirt on this planet, and I'm going to grow drugs instead of food? I feel like a hypocrite. I nagged Cole to quit smoking every day of our marriage."
"Well, honey, you didn't ask the whole world to quit smoking, and by the way, they didn't."
"I know. It's the only reliable crop around here you can earn enough from to live off a 5-acre bottom in a county that's 95% too steep to plow. I know why every soul in this end of 3 states grows tobacco, knowing full well the bottom's going to drop out any day now.
They're trapped. They're trapped."
Jewel paused between jars and pointed the ladle toward the back window, the one that faced up Bitter Hollow toward the mountain.
"You've got timber."
Lusa shook her head. "I couldn't log this hollow."
"Well, but you could. That hollow goes up 1/2 mile or more before you get to national forest land. We used to think those woods went on forever."
"I will not cut down those trees. I don't care if there's $100,000 worth of lumber on the back of this farm. I'm not selling it. It's what I love best about this place."
"What, the trees?"
"The trees, the moths, the foxes, all the wild things that live up there. It's Cole's childhood up there, too, along with yours and your sister's." That's so. Cole loved it best of any of us.
Cole did? He always acted like the woods and the briar patches of this world were enemy number one.
Well, farming, you know, you got to do what it takes.
Yep, and around here that's tobacco, I guess, if I want to keep this farm. I just wish I could be the one person to think of a door out of that trap.
Jewel smiled. You and Cole. He used to say that.
What?
That he'd be the first one in this county to make a killing off something besides tobacco.
When did he say that?
Oh, he was 16, maybe. Future Farmers of America and high school running back star, what a combination. Much too interested in his good looks to smoke a cigarette, mind you, or grow plain old ordinary tobacco. He was going to set the world on fire. He tried red bell peppers one year and cucumbers the next, potatoes the next.
No, he never told me that.
I'm telling you, right out here in Daddy's bottom field, every year, whatever it was, it failed, and he had to eat a little more of his pride. He grew up in those 3 years from dreamer to farmer, gave up his pipe dreams, and started smoking.
Lucy shook her head. I can't picture that. I know Cole was energetic, but I can't picture that he was ever so, what, starry-eyed.
She laughed. Plus, I figured he was born smoking. Like a fish, he was hooked.
No, I remember being shocked to see him smoking with the men at Mommy's wake. So it was right around then when Mommy died. The very next year, Daddy cleaned out the barn and signed the farm over to Cole, and then he died too. Seemed like he could trust Cole to be a man, finally. He'd be able to handle anything that came along after the red bell peppers, the cucumbers, and the potatoes.
Anything but a steering column through his rib cage, Lucy thought morbidly, recognizing how self-pity could push its nose into any conversation like a tiresome dog. It took so much energy to keep Cole outside her thoughts for a single minute, and yet people still said, "I didn't want to remind you."
What could go wrong with potatoes? Lucy forced herself to ask.
It seems like such a sure thing. Good yielder, easy to transport, and you could spread out the harvest.
It was the funniest thing. They said he could make a profit if he could get them down to the potato chip factory in Knoxville. But then when he did, it didn't work out. They liked the Idaho potatoes better. The ones that grow around here have too much sugar in them. It makes them slice ragged and burn around the edges.
Too much sugar?
That's what they said. This bottom land's too rich. I mean, they're good potatoes, just not good for the market.
Jewel, my life sounds like a country song. My roof's a-caving in, my land's too steep to plow, and my bottom's got too much sugar.
Your bottom. Jewel startled Lucy by smacking her with a dish towel.
Let's get your bottom to cleaning up this mess. You are not going to starve, Loretta Lynn.
Jewel piled things up to carry to the sink while Lucy plunged her hands into soapy water so hot it prickled her skin. The hurt felt like a punishment that would clean the ache out of her chest. The rain was picking up again, starting to hammer a quiet roar on the tin roof, playing Zeta Landowski's music. Yesterday was the anniversary of her wedding, which nobody had mentioned all day, but Zeta had regaled her all through the rainy night playing klezmer tunes on his clarinet. The Jewish wedding she never had. She and Cole had made a small ceremony of it in the Hunt Morgan Garden in Lexington, outdoors, to sidestep the issue of religion. That had been fine with Cole. He wasn't churchy like his sisters.
Jewel, I want to tell you something. Just let me say this. I loved my husband.
Well, sure you did.
In her mind's eye, Lucy pictured the lower field, back when he'd first set out to make it his own. A moving sea of leaves turning lightly in the breeze, the bobbing red bells of ripening peppers, a young man wading through them the way he would walk into a lake. Cole, at 19. A man she never met.
We never got a chance to hit our stride, maybe. You all still think I don't really know who he was, but I did. I do. We talked a lot. He told me things. Just a few days before he died, he told me something amazing.
Jewel looked up.
What? Can I ask?
Lucy crossed her arms over her stomach, holding her breath, transported by the scent memory of honeysuckle across a field,
like a moth. Here I am. We're here. She glanced over at Jewel. I am sorry. It won't make any sense to you. It's nothing I can say in words.
Well, Jewel said, turning away. She was disappointed, Lusa could see. Now she thought Lusa was withholding something important, some piece of her brother that would help bring him back.
Never mind. I'm sorry, Jewel, but really it's nothing that matters now. Just that we were right for each other, for sure. Just like you and Shell were in the beginning, even though everybody's poisoned it now by taking a bad end and working backward.
Jewel passed the sponge from one hand to the other while she studied Lusa.
Nobody's saying you didn't love him.
Nobody thinks they're saying that.
She could feel Jewel's scrutiny but couldn't look up. She turned back to the sink and leaned into the sticky preserve pot and scrubbed it hard to keep herself from crying or yelling, her whole body pumped with the effort.
My Lord, honey, what's this about?
That thing about changing my name back, for instance? My husband's hardly cold in the grave, and already I've run to the courthouse to erase his family name from the deed to your family farm? That's for shit! What kind of mean-spirited lie is that, and who made it up?
Jewel hesitated. Lois saw your signature on something at the funeral home.
Loud Lois, Lusa thought uncharitably, picturing that long face permanently puckered with worry that someone else was getting her share. I always had the same name, before, during, and after Cole. Lusa Maloof Landowski. My mom's Palestinian and my dad's a Polish Jew, and never before I came here did I think that was anything to be ashamed of. I've had it since I was born. Not that I've ever heard anybody in your family say it. You talk about making somebody disappear? You think they put the vanishing act on Shell? Try living in a family that won't learn your damn name.
She and Jewel blinked at each other, shocked equally.
Nobody meant any harm, honey. It's just normal to take your husband's name around here. We're just regular country people with country ways.
It never struck me as a regular thing to do, so we just didn't. God, Jewel, did you all really believe I'd take his name and then throw it back a week after he died? Some carpetbagger erasing your family name and stealing your home place? Is that how you see me?
Jewel had her hand on her mouth, and tears were welling up in her eyes. They were back where they'd started. Lusa had raised her voice at this timid woman who was probably the nearest thing she had to a friend in the family or this county. Jewel shook her head and held out her arms to Lusa, who stepped awkwardly into her hug. Jewel's body felt as bony and light as a bird's underneath her apron, all feathers and heartbeat. They clung to each other for a minute, rocking back and forth.
Don't pay any attention to me, Lusa said. I'm losing my mind. There are ghosts here. There's one in this kitchen that stirs up fights.
Over Jewel's shoulder, she could look straight down the hall through the wavy antique glass in the front door to the outside, the yard and front pasture. This rain would never end, she thought. She could see the fresh beginnings of yet another storm coming, the leaves of the tulip poplar down by the barn trembling and rotating on 100 different axes, like a tree full of pinwheels. Beneath it, Lowell and Crystal orbited the barnyard in their dark, soaked clothes, laughing and galloping on a pair of invisible horses, traveling in circles through the infinite downpour, as if time for them had stopped or not yet started.
This ends Disc 4.